Good evening, everyone. We'll go ahead and get started. I recognize many of the faces in the room. For those of you who I don't recognize, my name is Dr. Benjamin Hopkins. I'm the director of the Seeger Center here at the Elliott School. It's my great pleasure to welcome you for our 23rd annual lecture this evening. We have a distinguished guest from Harvard this evening, Professor Arne Vestad. Before I introduce Arne, though, however, it's my pleasure as well to say a couple of words about the Seeger Center. The Seeger Center, for those of you who don't know, is the university's center for Asian studies. We have a long and illustrious history, and our namesake, Gaston Seeger, some of his family is here this evening, and I'd like to recognize them. Paul and Susie Seeger are up front joining us for this evening's lecture, both of whom are Elliott School alumni. I'll spare them the years, but in the none too distant past. And I should also note the remembrance of Paul's mother, Estelle, who passed away peacefully in November of 2017, and we were very sorry to hear of that loss. With that said, it's my pleasure to introduce Professor Arne Vestad, who is the S.T. Lee Professor of U.S. and Asian Relations at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Before coming to Harvard in 2015, Arne was the School Professor of International History at the London School of Economics and Political Science, where he arrived as a professor in 1998, the same year I arrived at the same institution in my first year of undergraduate studies. Now, while at LSE, he directed the LSE Ideas Institute, which is a leading center for international affairs, diplomacy, and strategy. And then, like any good academic, he jumped the pond to join us over here in 2015. A leading global thinker, he is an expert on contemporary international history and on the Eastern Asian region, particularly. His numerous publications include The Global Cold War, Third World Interventions, and the Making of Modern Times, which was the winner of the Bancroft Prize, amongst other many recognitions. He served as general editor for the three-volume Cambridge History of the Cold War and is the author of The Penguin History of the World, presently in its sixth edition. He has also authored Restless Empire, China and the World Since 1750, which was published in 2013, and the winner of the Asia Society Book Award, and just recently published The Cold War, A World History, hot off the presses in the autumn of 2017. Today, he will be speaking to us about his new book project, which is both a return to form with its focus on East Asia, but also an extension of his repertoire back in time. He is entitled today's talk, Chinese-Korean Relations, Empire and Righteous Nation, 600 Years of China-Korea Relations. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Professor Arne Vestad.
Thank you very much, Ben, for that wonderful introduction. It's great to be back in Washington. It's wonderful to be back at GW, one of my favorite institutions, this side of the pond, because it's done so much to develop research in the areas that I'm interested in. So not just here at the Seeger Center and at the Elliott School, but in more general terms as well, dealing with Asia, dealing with the Cold War, the things that I'm most preoccupied with. It's wonderful to meet up with old friends. So as Ben said, I've known him since he was an undergraduate at LSE, and it's been wonderful to see that he has really made his mark in terms of international affairs and history, and done so here. Good match, if I may say so, both for GW and for Ben, but also a number of other people who I see in the audience who I've interacted with over the years here in Washington. So I want to thank the Seeger Center, I want to thank the Elliott School of International Affairs, and Ben, of course, especially for inviting me to do these lectures. I also want to, since I had a chance to talk a little bit with Gaston Seeger's family before we started up here to recognize Gaston Segura as in his role, maybe first and foremost as Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs during the Reagan administration. So I've had the privilege of working on Mr. Segura's papers in the Reagan Presidential Library. They were released, or most of them were released, not long ago. And some of his efforts have a very direct connection to what is the situation today between the United States and South Korea. So that was one of the many issues that he worked on as Assistant Secretary, and where I think quite a lot of progress was made at the time, some of which didn't quite materialize later on, but may in part, and I'll get to this later on, form a pattern for some of the interactions that we see on the Korean Peninsula today. So it's doubly meaningful to be here tonight to give a lecture in his name. So it's a pretty tall order that we have before us tonight, ladies and gentlemen. It's not easy within about 50 minutes, which is what I promised then that I would stick to give an overview of a very important bilateral relationship over a period of roughly 600 years. So I will divide this into three parts. In the first part, so the first 15 minutes or so, I will deal with 500 years of China-Korea relations. In the second 15-minute interval, I will deal with about 100 years of China-Korea relations. And in the third part, I will deal with so the last 2 weeks or so of of China-Korea relations. So I think that's about right in terms of where people's interests are. But one mustn't forget the first part in order to try to make sense of what is going on today. So that's the reason why I chose this particular topic, and why I'm making a small book that Harvard Press will publish probably at the beginning of next year on this topic, coming out of these lectures. I gave a first version of the lectures at Harvard last year, then divided into three lectures over three consecutive evenings, and I've also done versions of these in Beijing and in Seoul. So I'm looking forward to the discussion of them here. Now I've done the three capitals, right? And I've done it here in Washington as well. So first of all, the title. The title is always important when you try to address something, particularly if you do it as an undergraduate lecture, but also when you do it for a broader audience. So why on earth have I called this lecture Empire and Righteous Nation? Now, let's start with righteous, and not surprisingly, that refers to Korea. It doesn't mean that all Koreans are righteous. It doesn't mean that any Korean state at any point or any form has necessarily been a righteous state. But the term is used here to indicate that a search for a righteous approach to domestic and international affairs has preoccupied generations of Koreans very, very much, perhaps more than what you've seen in many other countries. Now, some of my Korean friends say that I mix up righteousness and rectitude, which are not exactly the same, but I'll talk more about that later on in terms of the overall approach. So, but do bear in mind that slight tongue-in-cheek reference to righteousness that's here in the title. But before we get to the Korean definition of the interactions, we have to start with China. The reason why we have to start with China is because China is the empire of the title, right? The heavier, if you like, of the two entities. And in order to understand something about China's relationship with Korea over this long period of time, I think it makes sense to think a little bit about what an empire is. Now, empires come in many different forms and in different shapes. They've been around for a very long time, at least for 5,000 years, since the Assyrian Empire around 2000 BC. So what is it, if we try to compare these various forms of empire that connect them? Central authority obviously connect them. If there is no central authority, there is no empire. There also has to be a systematic form of thinking to regulate the relationship between the center and the various peripheries that exist within an empire. And that's roughly where the comparisons end, because after that, empires tend to be very different and behave very, very differently. So some empires colonize externally. Not all empires do. Some empires are born more or less in the shape that they have later on and can stay with for a very long time. If you think about it in the European context, Ireland, for instance, Algeria, both settled by colonialists coming from the imperial center. In that sense, there is a certain reference to Korea and the Korean experience in this, being on the borders of the imperial center. But in this case, Chinese settlements in Korea were exceedingly rare during the period that we're looking at. There were people who settled on both sides of the border, but in very, very small numbers, and certainly very different in terms of numbers from the only real attempt at settling foreign colonialists in Korea, which was during the Japanese occupation from 1910 to 1945, when more than 1 million Japanese settled in Korea. So that was a much bigger wave than anything that you saw during the long period of China-Korea interaction. If you really want to go back in time, and I think this makes sense for people who want to look at this relationship, it is useful to think about the similarities and the differences between the Qin and Han empires in China, or in the Chinese area, and the Hellenistic and Roman empires in the West. Not because of the similarities between the two or the differences, so much that both of them created the format for empire in Asia and Europe. And some of the aspects of these formats have been with us for the last 2,000 years, and are probably still around when we discuss what empire means in a sort of broader sense. So on the Chinese side, I think what most of the various Chinese empires that have developed since Qin and Han, and there have been many of them, of course, what they have in common are first and foremost two things. There is on the Chinese side a sense of cultural centrality within its wider region. The region is in many ways, by all of these Chinese empires, going up to the People's Republic today, a definition of their world. But it's also important to see this within a framework of China's orientation. And this is what many Westerners get wrong. China has always been oriented eastward, right, towards the eastern seaboard, with some very brief exceptions during the Tang Empire, for instance, and maybe briefly during the Song. But for most of Chinese history, its orientation has been towards the east, away from the rest of Eurasia, but towards Korea, towards Japan, towards Vietnam. I think that's important. So cultural centrality, but within a direction in terms of where the gaze is turned. And secondly, in terms of connecting these various empires, going from the Han and up to today, a strong emphasis on hierarchy. Hierarchies internationally, hierarchies domestically. And through that, an emphasis on bureaucratic governance. This is what Benjamin Swartz calls this tremendous weight of the state in China and in Chinese governance systems. Now, many empires and many national states have an emphasis on the state, right? For understandable reasons. Russia, for instance, is often used as an example of this, but you find other European examples as well. But there is nothing quite like China in terms of the longevity, the durability of this emphasis on the state as being at the center of Chinese civilization and Chinese society. And I think it's important to bear that in mind when we think about its foreign relations as well. Which brings us to the tribute system. Now, I promised to bring up the tribute system in this talk, and I will. So The tribute system, as my Harvard predecessor John King Fairbank defined it, was a system through which China, through in slightly different ways, and he was open to that, through various empires, regulated its relationship with its wider region. Now, I must confess that the more I have looked at this in terms of Chinese foreign policy over the past 2,000 years, the more it has struck me that the tribute system has been more of a system at Harvard than it ever was in Asia. There is no doubt that tribute existed and that it was important. And there is no doubt that various Chinese empires integrated their neighbors, particularly culturally, in a very deliberate kind of way. But it was done differently, towards different areas and at different times. So emphasizing these differences is essential for understanding the relationship between China and Korea, because there is no other relationship within the region that it can really be compared to, right? It's a different kind of relationship today and in history than what China has with any of its other neighbors. And I think that is important. So tribute existed, but there was no unified system. There were different frameworks of tribute, of trade, of terminology, not least, that governed this longer period in terms of China's interaction with the outside world. So the two Chinese empires that we cover tonight are the Ming and the Qing. The Ming, as most of you here will know, runs for almost 300 years, from the 1360s to the 1640s, or thereabouts. And the Qing, from the 1640s to 1912, also for almost 300 years. So these are long time periods, right? These are polities that survived for a very long period of time, also by Chinese standards, by the way. And that is important, because if you look at the relationship between China and Korea, that sense of durability, endurance, in terms of how the polities were organized, has a very significant impact on the relationship itself. It also has a great deal of impact in terms of how the two sides saw each other. So how authority, for instance, is understood. And I often, when I lecture on this, draw on Max Weber's and his typologies of the state with regard to this, both on the Chinese and, as we'll hear later, on the Korean side, what Weber calls traditional authority. But if there's going to be anything that is meaningfully called tradition, it has to be around for a while, right? And that's true, I think, for these two Chinese imperial institutions, and even more so for the Joseon on the Korean side, that we'll get to a little bit later on, because it lasted even longer. What's particularly important with Weber is not so much the characterization that sometimes have been made into a caricature. It is Weber's insistence that, and I quote him on this, that bureaucratic administration, as in China, means fundamentally domination through knowledge, unquote. So that emphasis on knowledge lasting for a long period of time, the accumulation of knowledge as a ordering factor within these empires and how it deals with the outside world, that's where I think the emphasis ought to be. Not on an integral system of political integration, but on how knowledge is used from the Chinese perspective, first and foremost, to understand the world around them. Because some of the elements of that knowledge are still with us today. And that's something that I think is crucial. It's not just crucial for China, of course, it's true with other empires as well. Knowledge reframe empires, right, in general. I think Ben can tell you a great deal about this. And that's important, but it's particularly important when you deal with an empire which is acting towards immediate and contiguous neighbors. Where Russia perhaps is the only other modern example that we have of that kind of imperial expansion. Which then brings us to nation. And this is the more controversial part of what I have to say initially. So Ming and Qing China were many things, but no one can meaningfully imagine them as nations. They were empires consisting of different parts, with an imperial institution at the center, which was deliberately transnational, always was. It had to be, because there were so many different peoples, groups, identities over which it ruled. Under one predominant elite, an attempt at expanding a central culture, absolutely, but with an emphasis necessarily on difference and differences. But if we then draw the similarities over to Korea, does it make sense to speak of 20th century Korea, as I do indirectly in my title, as a nation? So historians have tried their best, we are good at this, at eluding that question by simply pointing to the great coherence in cultural and linguistic terms of people who today live on the Korean Peninsula, right? A process that goes back in genetic terms at least 3,000 years, and is relatively interrupted. Relatively uninterrupted. In linguistic terms, and many of you here will know this, modern Korean derives from Middle Korean, which in turn derives from, you probably guessed it, Old Korean, which has its roots in some form of Proto-Korean, you know, if you go back 2,000 years or so. So this is something that's been around for a very, very long time. And there is no two ways about that. You can't get away from that. There is a continuity in these particular terms, which of course not everything, right? But is significant in terms of the population and in terms of the language that they speak. But some of this, as I've argued elsewhere, is a typical historian's cop-out, right? So not everything that is distinct becomes a nation in any meaningful sense of the term. I like, by the way, the Oxford English Dictionary definition of a nation. They say that nation is best defined as a large body of people united by common descent, history, culture, or language, inhabiting a particular state or territory. So that definition emphasizes something in common, and it emphasizes co-location, which is, in my view, about as far as you can go when you are talking about nations. Right? If you want to be more specific than that, you always get into trouble. So one of my earlier colleagues at LSE, Ernst Gellner, was the one who first pointed out with great force that in order to understand nations, you have first to understand nationalists, right? And his was very much a contemporary European take on the concept of nation. Gellner said, nationalists create the nation, not the other way around, right? And that's been followed up by other people. There's a long LSE tradition on this. Tony Smith is the more recent of them, who query and challenge the concept of nation. In terms of how it's being created. And I'm in favor of all of that. I think it's very, very important to do. But I also think it's important to see differences between different cultural traditions in terms of how you understand that cohesiveness that we sometimes put under the heading of nation. So Korea defined in terms of its history, possibly in terms of its ethnicity, certainly in terms of its culture and civilization, something which became particularly important against the Qing, bears in it, at least for me, in a meaningful comparative sense, much of what those who defined concepts of nation in 19th century Europe seem to have been looking for. Right? So therefore, I think it's meaningful, at least for the sake of debate, to think about Korea going back at least to the late 16th century as some kind of nation or proto-nation in terms of its cohesiveness. Probably wouldn't have been around today otherwise. Okay, so what then about the righteousness in all of this? Now righteous in classical Chinese is yi, or ui in Korean, which means we define in different forms: moral fitness, loyalty, fidelity to principles, possibly also rectitude, I mean, meaning the quality of being correct or being true. But I particularly like righteousness, I mean, the state or quality of being righteous and just. And the reason I like that so much is that in this classical Neo-Confucian concept coming out of 11th and early 12th century China, that's where most of the discussion has been. What does it mean in a Confucian context to be righteous or to be just? How do you organize your life and your state and your society in order to live up to those kinds of ideals? How do you fight for it when necessary? It's not unimportant in this context that the Korean Popular Army that was raised against Japanese invasions in the 1580s was named the Righteous Army, or Uibyeong, right? This has a significance in terms of the definition. And that's not the same thing as saying that all Koreans are righteous. But it is saying that this concept has had a particular meaning in Korean Neo-Confucianism that goes all the way up to today. And I think also plays a role in terms of today's relations between China and Korea and the United States and Korea, for that matter. So let me then just provide a brief overview of Korea and China coming out of the late 14th century. And why the late 14th century? Well, this is because the Ming and the Great Joseon dynasty were created roughly at the same time. And they were very much about the same kind of things. So the Ming was about a revitalization of Chinese tradition. But it was also about regulating China's relations to surrounding states. It's fascinating to look in the late 14th, early 15th century, how quickly that ordering of China's relationship with the outside world appears on the Ming agenda. Right? It was something that they were really preoccupied with. In that sense, the Ming was a project. It was a specific project connected to various forms of Neo-Confucian thinking. But if the Ming was a project, the Joseon in Korea was even more of a project, connected to the same kind of ideas. It could be said to be, in many ways, the supreme Neo-Confucian project, right? Because it was so distinctly ideological. Ideological within a sense of state building. But what did it consist of? I think it's important to understand it as an attempt at a complete remaking of Korean society according to the principles of Neo-Confucianism. It was very narrow in many ways, but it was also deep in terms of what the state and significant parts of society outside of the state eventually came to do. So state and society were structured according to the moral principles that the Joseon elites saw as governing the universe. Harmony, hierarchy, family, self-cultivation and learning, and, you're not too surprised to hear this, the concept of righteousness, how you should live your lives. So Joseon was an ideologically driven state to a remarkable degree for as long as it lasted, all the way up to the beginning of the 20th century. It was also remarkably successful to the degree that it survived the biggest challenge of the time, which was very much as Korea is today, being caught between China and Japan, two expanding Chinese empires, the Ming and the Qing, and the reconstitution of Japanese power. And it outlasted all of the political rearrangements in China and Japan, simply by going on and on and on, and never giving up, which again is very much, I think, dependent on the ideological framework that underpinned it, and the conviction about these values. Surviving the Great East Asian Wars, which I don't have time to go into today, of the late 16th century, was quite a feat. And the Joseon were able to do it simply because they refused to capitulate, because capitulation would have meant giving up on these ideas that they believed governed not just Korea, but governed the region, or for that matter, governed the universe. So ideology is a very important part of this.